All right, so today we're diving into some really heady stuff, ready to connect some dots that, on the surface, might seem worlds apart.
Sounds intriguing. Always up for a challenge.
Well, we've got David Pearce's Myths manuscript. He takes on some pretty fundamental assumptions in welfare economics, how we think about value, social choices, even Arrow's impossibility theorem.
Arrow's theorem. Always a good one for a lively debate.
Exactly. And then we're going to shift gears to a paper by James Boudreau and his colleagues. They're exploring how we could use, get this, market design principles to rethink the U.S. Electoral College.
Wow, okay. Market design and elections. That's an interesting pairing. Color me curious.
The goal here is to kind of sift through these dense sources, pull out the real gems of insight, and hopefully uncover some surprising links between these seemingly separate areas. By the end, we'll have a much clearer, more nuanced view of just how tricky it is to translate individual desires into something we can call the will of the people. You know, that whole what we as a society should do thing.
That's a big one, all right. A fundamental challenge of democracy, really. I'm ready to dive in. Where do we start?
Let's start with Pearce's Myths manuscript, which goes right for the foundational stuff. First myth he tackles, the idea that if we can't directly observe how strongly someone prefers something, what economists call preference intensity, then it's essentially meaningless.
Okay, so if we can't measure it, it doesn't matter. That's a pretty bold statement. I assume Pierce has some thoughts on that.
Oh, he does, big time. This idea goes back to Samuelson, who basically said, if it doesn't have a measurable impact on what we see happening, just chuck it out the window. But Pearce makes a really compelling counterargument. He says, just because we can't stick a precise number on how much more someone prefers one thing over another doesn't mean that intensity isn't real. And it's certainly not irrelevant, especially when we're making decisions that affect a whole bunch of people.
Yeah, that makes sense. Intuitively, we know that some people feel much more strongly about certain things than others, even if we can't quantify it perfectly.
Right. And he illustrates this with a great example. Imagine we have to choose between two policies, policy A and policy B. Policy A, a lot of people like it, but they only like it slightly more than the alternative. Then there's policy B, a much smaller group loves this one intensely, while everyone else is basically neutral.
So, if we're just looking at who prefers what, policy A would probably win because it has more supporters, even if it's just a slight preference for most.
Exactly. But, and here's Pierce's point, we'd be completely ignoring the fact that policy B is creating a significantly higher level of well-being for that smaller group, and it's not really hurting anyone else.
So, for our listeners, the takeaway is that ignoring how strongly someone cares about something, even if we can't perfectly measure it, can lead to decisions that don't actually maximize overall well-being.
Right, and it's something we see play out in everyday life. Think about choosing a movie for family night. Everyone might sort of want to see the new action flick, but then there's that one person who really, really wants to see the animated movie and would be super bummed if they missed out. Ignoring that stronger preference, even if more people slightly prefer the action movie, just doesn't seem right, does it?
It doesn't know. And I think this leads nicely into the second myth Pearce tackles. This idea that because we can't measure utility, that underlying satisfaction we get from things, with a precise cardinal scale like we can with temperature, then we should only focus on those simple ordinal rankings of, I prefer this to that.
And Arrow himself actually used the temperature analogy, didn't he? He said, we can use Celsius or Fahrenheit, but the underlying reality of what's hotter or colder doesn't change.
Yeah, he did. And therefore, according to this line of thinking, it's supposedly meaningless to compare how much more utility someone gets from different levels of well-being.
But Pierce pushes back on this in a pretty vivid way with his hotel tennis court example.
Oh, yes, the tennis court. This is a great one. Imagine you arrive at a hotel and they offer you a choice. Half hour of tennis in the morning or a full hour in the afternoon. They say the weather will be pretty much the same, just a bit hotter in the afternoon.
So you ask, well, how much hotter? And they hit you with, temperature isn't fundamentally cardinal, sir. Only the ordinal information that it will be hotter is
Because
relevant.
Pierce's point, of course, is that this is completely ridiculous. If it's going to be 25 degrees C in the morning and 26 degrees C in the afternoon, well, you might prefer that longer afternoon session, right?
Totally. But what if it's 27 degrees C in the morning and a scorching 48 degrees C in the afternoon? Suddenly, that difference is a really big deal. It could even be dangerous.
Exactly. The size of the difference in temperature, that magnitude, completely changes your decision and impacts your well-being. And so, listeners, While measuring happiness or satisfaction might be trickier than measuring temperature, we can't just dismiss those differences in how much better or worse something is. It matters. And we implicitly consider this all the time.
We do. We might not be able to put an exact number on it, but we have a sense of whether that new phone upgrade is a minor improvement or a game changer.
Right, game changer. So, yeah, this idea that we should only care about the order of our preferences and not the strength of those preferences, it's just not how we operate in the real world.
Absolutely. And that takes us to myth three. The idea that when we're making decisions for a group or thinking about social welfare, all that matters is how each option ranks against every other option in a pairwise comparison, X versus Y, Y versus Z. We don't need to worry about how they compare to other seemingly irrelevant options. And this is where the concept of the independence of irrelevant alternatives, IIA, enters the picture.
IIA. This is a cornerstone of Arrow's work, and Pierce has some interesting thoughts on it.
He does. So to refresh everyone, IIA basically says if we're comparing, say, option A and option B, our overall preference between those two shouldn't be affected by how we feel about some option C that's out there, but not part of the direct comparison. It's irrelevant, right?
Right, in theory. But Pierce challenges this with a really clever thought experiment involving two people and four possible outcomes, X, Y, W, and Z. Each person has a clear ranking of these four.
Got it.
And then there's an observer who's trying to determine, based on these individual rankings, whether society prefers X to Y. What Pierce shows is that even if the observer finds society indifferent between X and Y when all four options are on the table, that preference can flip if the set of available options changes, like if W and Z suddenly disappear.
So even though X and Y are still there, the fact that W and Z are gone somehow changes how those two stack up against each other. That's counterintuitive.
It is. But Pierce's point is that the existence or non-existence of these seemingly irrelevant alternatives can actually tell us a lot about the intensity and structure of those underlying preferences. By ignoring that broader context, which IIA tells us to do, we might end up with a social ranking of X and Y that doesn't actually reflect what people truly want.
I think an analogy might help here. Let's say you're trying to choose between two restaurants, a burger joint and a pizza place. Your preference might be influenced by whether the third option on the table is a fancy French bistro or a greasy spoon diner. The presence of that third option, even if you're not seriously considering it, tells you something about the overall spectrum of choices and might make one of the initial two seem more or less appealing.
The French bistro might make that burger joint look even better, right?
Exactly. And this leads to Pierce's myth four, the concern that if we reject IIA in social choice, we're somehow saying it's also invalid for individual decision-making or even Nash bargaining in economics. He's quick to point out that's not the case at all. The difference comes down to information.
Right. So when you're making a rational choice as an individual, the mere presence of an additional option shouldn't change your core preferences. If you prefer burgers to pizza, the fact that sushi exists shouldn't suddenly make you a pizza lover.
Right, assuming the burger and pizza haven't changed, of course.
Of course. And in Nash bargaining, all the parties involved are fully aware of the entire range of possible agreements. So taking one potential outcome off the table, even if it's a less desirable one, doesn't change the fundamental trade-offs between the remaining options. Everyone's still got the full picture.
So in those cases, the irrelevant alternatives don't provide any new information that would logically alter the decision.
Right. But in social choice, it's different because those other options tell us something about the intensity and the way preferences are spread across a group.
Okay. And that brings us to what might be the biggest myth of all. Myth five. The idea that Arrow's impossibility theorem proves any fair and logical way of combining individual preferences into a collective decision is just fundamentally impossible. The one that makes people feel like democracy is doomed.
The big one. And it's a real head-scratcher. But Pierce offers a fresh way of looking at this, doesn't he?
He does. He really encourages us to think critically about the conditions that lead to Arrow's famous impossibility result. Basically, the theorem says, if you want a social decision-making rule that has some reasonable properties.
Reasonable properties like what?
Well, things like it gives us a complete and consistent ranking of social preferences. It respects unanimous preferences. And it's not just dictated by one person. If we want all that, then we inevitably run into a conflict with IIA. It's like we can't have it all.
A tough pill to swallow for those who believe in the power of collective decision-making.
Totally. But Pierce's big insight here is that maybe, just maybe, it's IIA itself that's the problem. In the context of social welfare, that is.
So he's suggesting that the problem isn't that combining preferences ethically is inherently impossible, but that the insistence on ignoring information as IIA demands is what throws a wrench in the whole thing.
Exactly. Imagine an observer trying to make a fair social choice. Pierce says we should think of them as a rational Bayesian decision maker.
Okay, so a Bayesian decision maker is someone who uses all the available information, even if it's just ordinal rankings, to make the most reasonable guess about what's really going on with people's preferences.
Right. And from this perspective, clinging to IIA actually starts to look a bit irrational because it forces us to deliberately ignore information that could help us understand how people feel about the different options.
So Pierce is basically reinterpreting Arrow's theorem.
Yeah.
He's not saying ethical aggregation is impossible, but that IIA clashes with other ethical principles if we're taking this more rational, information-seeking approach.
And for our listeners, the key is this. The very information that IIA tells us to ignore is often crucial for making informed and ethical choices that reflect what society truly values. We can't just blind ourselves to potentially useful insights.
That's a powerful point. It's like trying to navigate a maze blindfolded.
Exactly. So ditching IIA doesn't give us a magic formula for perfect social decisions, but it does open up the possibility for better, more nuanced approaches than the traditional, somewhat gloomy interpretation of Arrow's theorem might allow.
Okay, so it was not a solution, but it unlocks more possibilities, and that has some real-world implications, doesn't it?
It does. Pierce points out that the traditional pessimistic view of Arrow's theorem has often been used to dismiss things like cost-benefit analysis, where we try to weigh the pros and cons of different policies.
Because if aggregating preferences is inherently flawed, then any attempt to do so is pointless.
Right. But by challenging IIA, Pierce's interpretation gives a boost to these practical efforts. It suggests that using the available information to make informed judgments about social welfare isn't a hopeless exercise. We can actually learn something from it.
Much more optimistic and, I think, realistic perspective.
Absolutely. And then finally, Pierce tackles myth six. The notion that simply having everyone's complete ranking of all the options is all we need to make a fair and ethical social decision.
So even having all the rankings perfectly laid out isn't enough. There's more to it.
Pierce says yes, even that has its limits, because it doesn't tell us anything about how much someone prefers one option over another or what it's actually like for them to experience those different options. A social observer doesn't have access to that inner world, so they're forced to make educated guesses using that Bayesian approach we talked about.
Right, filling in the gaps with the best information available.
Exactly. And Pierce critiques methods like the board account, which assigns points based on rank, because they can bake in hidden assumptions that not everyone might agree with. For instance, the way it handles preferences could, without anyone intending it, end up favoring certain income distributions over others. He briefly touches on some of John Harsanyi's work, where he suggested that with enough information and if everyone's acting ethically, individual preferences might converge towards a shared idea of social welfare. And then there's the idea of making choices behind a double veil of ignorance.
A double veil of ignorance. Now that's an intriguing concept. So not only do you not know your economic status in this hypothetical society, but you also don't even know your own individual identity.
Right. So Pierce's point is that knowing everyone's ranked list of preferences is a good starting point, but it's not the whole story. Making truly ethical social choices requires careful judgment and a willingness to acknowledge that we can't know everything about people's inner experiences and the depth of their feelings.
It's a humbling reminder that even with perfect information on how people rank things, there's always more to the story. And making ethical choices requires careful thought and perhaps a bit of humility.
I like that. A bit of humility. And Pierce concludes by saying that this insistence on treating anything we can't directly observe as meaningless has really held back our understanding of how to analyze welfare. And it's given us a skewed perspective on what Arrow's theorem actually tells us. His suggestion is that we embrace a more nuanced understanding of Arrow's work. We should be willing to use our best judgment, maybe even incorporating new types of data in the future, because this actually supports the kind of practical welfare analysis we need to do. It doesn't undermine it.
Makes sense. Don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Now, I'm really curious to see how all of this connects to the paper on the Electoral College.
Let's get to that. So we've got this paper by Boudreau and his colleagues, and they're applying market design principles to the very practical challenge of Electoral College reform.
Okay, from deep philosophical questions about preference aggregation to reforming how we elect a president. I'm hooked.
And this actually ties in nicely with Pierce's critique of focusing solely on rankings, because Boudreau and his team start by highlighting how the current system, in practice, often ignores the intensity of preferences.
Yeah, the whole winner-take-all system in most states means you could win by a single vote and still get all the electoral votes. A landslide victory and a narrow squeaker look exactly the same in the Electoral College.
Exactly. And Boudreau and his co-authors point to the growing number of times the winner of the popular vote hasn't actually won the presidency, 2000, 2016, and even the near miss in 2024. They argue that this can really erode public trust in the system, and it creates this situation where presidential campaigns become almost entirely focused on just a handful of swing states.
Which leaves voters in the vast majority of states feeling like their vote doesn't really count.
Right, and I'm sure many of our listeners have experienced that feeling of, why bother if you happen to live in a state that's already considered safe for one party or the other?
Yeah, my vote doesn't matter. Not a great feeling for a healthy democracy.
Exactly. So instead of just arguing about the Electoral College versus a national popular vote, Boudreau and his team propose something really interesting. They suggest looking at this through the lens of market design.
Market design. So like designing a market for dot votes.
Well, not exactly. They point out how market design has already been used really effectively in all sorts of areas, like auctioning off limited radio frequencies, designing systems for matching medical school grads with residency programs, things like that. The basic idea is you clearly define what you want to achieve, and then you design the rules and mechanisms that are most likely to get you there. And crucially, you build in the capacity to adapt and improve the system over time based on how it actually works.
So it's not about finding a perfect off-the-shelf solution. It's about taking a more deliberate, almost engineered approach and being open to tweaking things along the way. And they even point out how the Electoral College itself has evolved over time, right?
They do. They mention things like the 12th Amendment, which separated the presidential and vice presidential ballots, and how the winner-take-all system became the norm at the state level. They also talk about past attempts to reform or even get rid of the Electoral College, like the Bayh-Seller Amendment, which almost passed. And there's the current National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. So there's this historical precedent for recognizing that the system could be better, and there have been efforts to change it.
So we're not just debating abstract principles. We're looking at a system with a real history of adaptations. And given this market design approach, what are some of the goals they think we should be aiming for? What makes a good electoral system?
Good question. They lay out several key goals, and the first, obviously, is legitimacy. The outcome should be viewed as fair and valid, and voters should feel like their vote actually matters. Second, they emphasize giving voters a way to express their preferences more fully, maybe even capturing the intensity of those preferences, which links back to what we were discussing with Pierce.
And third?
Third is limiting undue influence, especially from big money donors. Then, of course, the system should be fairly simple and transparent so voters can understand how it works. And crucially, it should facilitate a peaceful transition of power. Finally, it needs to be flexible, adaptable to future challenges and changing needs. And they make a really important point, which is that maximizing one of these goals might mean compromising on another. There are always trade-offs.
That's key. No system is going to be perfect on every dimension.
Absolutely. And with this in mind, let's look at how they apply this market design perspective to some potential reforms.
Okay, so what are some of the contenders?
One big one they discuss is ranked choice voting, or RCV. This one's been getting a lot of attention lately, and as we touched on with Pierce, it lets voters rank candidates in order of preference. If no one gets a majority of first-place votes, the candidate with the fewest is eliminated, and their votes are redistributed based on the voter's second preferences. This keeps going until someone reaches a majority. It's designed to make sure the winner has broad support.
And didn't Alaska recently adopt RCV?
They did. And Boudreau and his colleagues actually examined the early experience in Alaska. And it shows that changing the rules doesn't automatically change everything. It doesn't suddenly make everyone participate fully in the ranking process. And it doesn't eliminate all the political maneuvering we see in elections.
So a cautionary tale that reform isn't a magic bullet.
Right. And it's worth noting that even within RCV, there's debate about the specific rules for eliminating candidates. Do you eliminate the one with the fewest first-place votes or the fewest total votes across all rankings? These different approaches can actually lead to different outcomes and could even affect whether a Condorcet winner, you know, the candidate who would beat every other candidate in a head-to-head matchup, actually wins the election. And speaking of real-world developments, several states had ballot initiatives on RCV in the last election. So this is a very live debate.
It is. So RCV is one option on the table. What else are they looking at?
Well, they delve into some more novel methods, like quadratic voting and storable votes. These try to give voters a way to express just how strongly they feel about a candidate or an issue.
How does that work?
Quadratic voting makes it increasingly expensive to cast more votes for the same candidate. So the first vote is cheap, the second costs more, the third even more, and so on. The idea is it prevents wealthy individuals or groups from just buying the election. Storable votes, on the other hand, let you save up votes to use on issues or candidates you care most about. So you could, in theory, bank your vote for years and then spend it all on one super important election or issue.
Interesting idea, but that does add a whole new layer of complexity, doesn't it?
It does, and Boudreau and his colleagues acknowledge that. They also look at approval voting, which lets you approve as many candidates as you like, and majority judgment, which has voters grade each candidate. These are seen as simpler options that might reduce negative campaigning and the spoiler effect. They point out that majority judgment, because it focuses on ratings rather than just rankings, might avoid some of the impossibility results that plague systems based solely on ordinal rankings.
Ah, there's that Pierce connection again, the limitations of purely ordinal information.
Exactly. And then, just for fun, they even throw in some more radical ideas, like compulsory voting, where everyone is required to vote, and non-geographic districts, like the somewhat amusing idea of districts based on people's last name.
Voting by last name, that would definitely shake things up.
It would, though they acknowledge that such drastic changes could have downsides, especially in terms of individual liberty and the connection between voters and their elected officials. They also touch on the idea of organizing voting around shared interests rather than geography. And they briefly consider how technology could be used to create more sophisticated and secure voting systems while emphasizing the need for transparency and auditability so we can trust the results.
Right. So we don't want to sacrifice transparency and trust for the sake of efficiency or security. So what's their ultimate takeaway? What's the best way to move forward?
Well, their main conclusion is that just switching to a national popular vote system might not be the best answer. It could disadvantage smaller states or lead to unintended consequences.
So they're advocating for a more cautious, evidence-based approach.
Exactly. They strongly favor this market design approach, encouraging experimentation at the local and state levels to see what works best in practice. Ranked choice voting is a great example that's already being tested in a few places. And they point to Alaska's recent near repeal of ranked choice voting as a reminder that even promising reforms need to be well implemented and potentially tweaked along the way.
So learn as you go, adapt, and keep refining the system.
Exactly. And they even talk about how improving election systems at the local and state levels could affect who gets elected to higher office.
Mm.
They even critique the way the major parties run their primaries. They suggest that the current delegate allocation systems for the Democrats and Republicans might actually favor candidates who are more ideologically extreme, as opposed to candidates who are more likely to win a general election. So if the goal is to win, maybe the party should focus on picking candidates who can appeal to a broader range of voters.
Fascinating. So improving the way we vote locally could have a ripple effect all the way to the top.
That's the idea. Well, this has been a deep dive indeed. We've covered a lot of ground, and I think it's pretty amazing how we managed to draw these unexpected connections between these two seemingly separate areas. We started with Pierce, who really got us thinking about the subtle ways we value things and make collective choices. And then we moved on to Boudreau and his team, who showed us how market design can offer a practical framework for tackling real-world challenges like electoral reform. Who would have thought?
And running through both of these discussions is that fundamental challenge.
Yeah.
How do we move from individual preferences to something we can call a collective decision? Pierce reminds us to be wary of overly simplistic approaches and to pay attention to the nuances of how people value things. And Boudreau's team gives us a way to think about actually designing the systems that we use to make those collective choices. It's all connected.
It is. And for our listeners out there, we'll leave you with this thought. If these market design principles can be used for allocating resources and even designing voting systems, where else might they be useful? Think about your own life, the challenges you care about, online communities, how resources are allocated within organizations, or even how you make your own complex decisions. Could a market design perspective offer a fresh approach?
It's a powerful set of tools, and we encourage you to explore some of these ideas further,
mm-hmm.
delve deeper into social choice theory, look at how different voting systems work, and pay attention to the ways in which the design of these systems, whether it's a small group decision or a national election, shapes the outcomes.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We'll catch you next time.